BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. It is Monday, May 7th, 2012, and this is podcast number 140. If you're looking through the Bad Quaker pages and you're looking through the different podcast numbers and so forth, and our numbering system is not obvious to you, if you don't see the obvious pattern there, well, maybe it's not so obvious. Maybe that's why you're not seeing it. But what we do here, and this is kind of a lesson for anybody who might be starting up a podcast or, you know, a blog or anything else like that, where you're going to have a long-term presence, specifically on the internet, where other people can will be using the files. But also, it's handy for, you know, just for general computer use around your home and so forth. Anyway, as you're looking at any of the file names for any of the BadQuaker.com podcasts, I'll give you a little explanation of what they are. Like this one right here that I'm recording right now. This is file 0203PC140, and then it'll have the title of whatever I named this podcast once I'm done making the podcast, and I go back and listen to it, and I hear what I'm talking about. But the pertinent part of the file name is the 0203PC140. Now, what you'll see in that is that the initial numbers, the 0203, is the actual file number. PC stands for podcast, and 140 stands for the 140th podcast. So, for example, we have the 0203 actually means there are 203 files. Some of them are podcasts, some of them are interviews, some of them are articles, some of them are compilations of several articles together. Whatever the file is that we save on the hard drive at badquaker.com, will be numbered in that sequence. The zero, like this one, is 0203. We started out with 0001, and the reason we didn't just start out with one, because as you know, most people know that use the computer very much, you get to 11, 12, 14, 20, 25, 30, 100, and they don't show up in sequence with the normal way that Windows thinking manages file names. They get all weird. But if you start out with a number of zeros, then 0001 like that, then you're guaranteed to not that they'll stay in sequence in Windows weird numbering methods all the way up to 9,999. So if we here at badquaker.com make more than 9,999 files, we'll probably get into a numbering problem. So when we began numbering, we gave that number, you know, of zeros to start us out. And then the PC 140 is this podcast is number 140. Okay, so I'm sure you didn't log in and start listening to badquaker.com or download badquaker.com in order to get 5 minutes of lecture on how to name files. But my point in that is that if you're going to do something like this to where you're going to put it out for the public, it's handy to think ahead how you're going to number them, because I've made this mistake so many times where I've started to do something and then I got halfway into it and I've already begun numbering things and I'm like 20 into a series and I realize, oh man, there's going to be like 500 of these. All the numbering is going to be totally messed up on it. So it's always important to think those things through and figure out how you want them to appear eventually and not just think of the one or two things that you're numbering right now. I do this with Photoshop. I used to do a lot more Photoshop than what I do currently. I may have talked about it on the podcast without getting into a big deal. I used to spend a lot of time, I volunteered a lot of time doing humorous and sometimes politically charged Photoshops for a particular very, very popular website. But I stopped doing that, and for a long story that I'm not going to get into. But what I found as handy in storing, because I needed just, you know, tons and tons and tons of stock photos to go through to get the pieces that I needed to cut out and add to Photoshop projects to make them look the way that I wanted. So what I would do with the pictures, let's say I would have a category of politics, and this is back in like 2005, 2006, 2007. And so, I would want like, I might need, 30 or 40 different pictures of Hillary Clinton so that I could choose from the different expressions and different settings and so forth so that I could mock her properly the way she deserves. So I would start out with, it would be like, 001 Hillary, 002 Hillary, 003 Hillary. And that way I could keep them all in sequence like that. Eventually I switched that around. And I started going like Hillary 001, Hillary 002, Hillary 003. Or if it was, like a waterfall 001, like that. And that way I could keep them all sorted out and I could go by category and get right to the one I wanted. So it made it very handy. But I learned that lesson through a lot of trial and error and through a lot of having, 20 different files all named different things, all with waterfall pictures and all, trying to distinguish which one was which and where they all were and everything. Okay, now I've wasted 8 minutes talking about computer files, and this is not the computer the computer helpline podcast. So, what are we? BadQuaker.com podcast is about the zero aggression principle, property rights, and liberty. Now, before I get into our main topic, I did want to touch a couple things. Well, first off, almost forgot. I want to give a little plug for a website. This website belongs to a friend that's just really a wonderful person, and I have to give a warning because this website is not an adult, like an adult website or something like that. It's not adult the way you use that word negatively. Although the images and the context of what's written there is not intended for kids. It's intended for mature viewing audiences. So I'm giving that warning that that doesn't necessarily, it's not like pornographic or whatever, but expect to find very frank and honest writing and pictures that might not be all that comfortable for some people to look at. Now, having said that, what this website is about, and the website is called littleglimpsesoflife.com, littleglimpsesoflife.com. And I'll put a link to it, assuming I can remember. I'll put a link to it in today's show notes for the podcast on the website, badquaker.com. Anyway, what this website is, Little Glimpses of Life, the author here takes pictures, pictures that people submit to her, or pictures that she finds on the internet, or pictures that she comes up with one way or the other, and she just takes a look at the picture And then she writes a short story based on that picture. And it's entirely, you know, it's not necessarily, let's say, I'll just pull up one here. She has a picture of the hilt of a, looks like Bronze Age Celtic sword. It's just the base of the sword with the hilt, and that's it. And it's very heavily rusted. No, it's not Bronze Age. This is Iron Age. So it's Iron Age Celtic sword. And using just this picture of the hilt, she writes a story purely out of her own imagination of how she's inspired by that picture. Or another picture here is a deer. It's a baby deer, kind of rolled up. It's got the little white spots on his little back, and he's kind of rolled up, taking a little nap or whatever. And then she writes a story based on her impressions of this little baby deer. And it's just wonderful stories. Like I said, I'll put a link on badquaker.com. And really, it's well worth it. Again, some of the writing is a little bold, and some of the pictures are not acceptable for all members of the family, so use discretion. But I find it just a wonderful, wonderful website with just... I just love these stories. They're so good. It's just, and none of them are big. They're all just little, you know, a couple paragraphs, sometimes less than that. And it's just a really good, touching thing. She only has a few of her stories on her website right now. She's done lots of them. And I'm hoping that she'll continue doing this, and she'll continue posting some of the older ones that she's done in the past. So anyway, one more time, that's littleglimpsesoflife.com. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about before we get into the main body of today's podcast was that yesterday, Sunday, the badquaker.com Facebook page hit 500 likes. So that was kind of a thrilling thing. You know, we started that out. I actually avoided Facebook for a really long time. I didn't want anything to do with Facebook. And then a friend asked a favor and said, look, you know, please make a Facebook login and come and like my site, because, you know, as a favor to me, please do this. I'm trying to get my... So I went over and I made a Facebook account, and I wasn't crazy about it. A lot of my other family members had already done it, and I just really didn't want to have anything to do with it. But I did. I got a Facebook account, and I liked my friend's page that he wanted me to like. And then I started poking around on there, and then people were saying, well, you know, if you're going to do this Bad Quaker thing, you ought to get the Bad Quaker page going. I don't know. I don't want to do that. So some of the other staff members here at Bad Quaker actually built the badquaker.com Facebook page site, and it's like, okay, there it is. Now you don't have any excuse, because prior to that I was like, I don't know, the password's confusing me, I don't like this, can't somebody else do this, you know. So they did, and so then there it was. And now, after all this time, not really all this time, it's only been, I don't know, maybe eight months, 9 months, something like that, that the Facebook, badquaker.com Facebook page has been around, and 500 likes. It seems to me like that's pretty good. That's pretty fast. I was doing a thing for a while. I have to kind of admit this. I was doing a thing for a while where every Thursday or Friday, something like that, I would try to put together some type of a... it's not a true Photoshop, because, you know, I'm not, you know, swapping heads or making pictures of things that don't exist or whatever. But I would try to find some kind of a picture that was provocative in some way, and then I'd try to put some kind of a provocative statement on it. So, for example, I did one. I did a whole series on the internment camps at Manzanar. This is a Manzanar. is an area in the eastern Sierra Nevada mountains in eastern California where the Japanese were put into a concentration camp during World War II. And I know the area very well. My children were born just a few miles north of where the old Manzanar camp was. And I've camped in that whole area up and down through the eastern Sierras. I just love that whole area up through there. There's a little creek right behind Manzanar called Shepherd Creek that I used to go and trout fish at. It's just a wonderful place. But when you come out of Shepherd's Creek, you come down the dirt roads out of the eastern Sierras, and here's the reservoir and parts of the camp that are still remaining, and the plaque commemorating the internment camp, and it's really rough to see it and realize that this is what Americans did to other Americans. It's rough, but anyway, that I wandered from my point there. So I did a whole series of these pictures. I found a series of pictures of the Manzanar concentration camps. And so I did a whole series of pictures where I put captions with them, and I put them on badquaker.com's Facebook page. And I started figuring out that if I did this every Thursday or Friday or so, two things, people would react in two different ways. I would get, according to how offensive, should I say it that way? No, provocative. Let's go with provocative. According to how provocative of the pictures and the statements that I made on the pictures were, I would oftentimes get anywhere from 2 or 3 to sometimes 10 or 15 people that would unlike the badquaker.com page on Facebook. But each time I would do that, let's say I would put up a particularly provocative picture, and I would get, let's say, 5 unlikes, 5 people would unlike the page, then I could expect to maybe get 7 or 10 new likes would come in as a result of that. So I started seeing this pattern. I was like, well, that's pretty cool. So I would just, as many weeks as possible, I wouldn't always be able to do this on Thursdays and Fridays, but as often as possible, by the end of the week, I would like to have one of those pictures ready so that I could load it on usually like a Friday night and let that hit Saturday morning when all the people logged on to Facebook, and then watch the angry people unlike my page, and then watch the like slowly increase more than it had lost. I thought that was pretty funny for a while. I wasn't able to keep up the pace with the pictures because everything that we've been going through with spring and trying to get the garden ready and the yards have been out of control, and everything that's going on with the family, and we've had, you know, all the different things that are going on. If you're new to the podcast, we've had 2 deaths in the family this year, and those were pretty close to each other, and we're still trying to recover from that. We're still trying to deal with all the paperwork involved and all the, you know, different factions of the family, trying to deal with everyone's needs and all this stuff together. At the same time, we're trying to keep a website up and rolling and trying to keep podcasts going. I'm not complaining, you know, really. It's just been very hectic, and so I haven't been able to keep up with the podcast the way I'd like to, and I haven't been able to keep up with doing the pictures that I'd like to, and we haven't been able to add pictures to the audio files and get them on YouTube the way we'd like to. But anyway, we're trying, and so that's a lot of talk for that you probably didn't log on to the podcast to hear. But I did want to mention that we hit 500 likes over the weekend, and we're very thrilled about that. And I should mention how we got that, not only because me playing with the little pictures, that was fun, but you know, I have to say there's a person on Facebook called the Libertarian Homeschooler, and there's a couple others too. There's one called I bet Ludwig von Mises can get more fans than John Maynard Keynes. This is the name of the Facebook page. And between, and there's been lots of people on Facebook that have shared and helped us to gain likes on Facebook and gain attention on Facebook. But I really wanted to mention the Libertarian Homeschooler and the moderators over at I Bet Ludwig von Mises Can Get More Fans Than John Maynard Keynes page. There's others too. You know, Punk Rock Homesteading is a really good friend over on Facebook, and the page called Capitalism, and also Free Your Kids, and Graphic Artists for Ron Paul, I think, is the other one. These are, and there are lots of others too. I mean, we have 500 likes, so I'd have to list all 500 individuals on Facebook to really do them justice. But those ones that I mentioned, most specifically the Libertarian Homeschooler and the folks over at what was it called? I bet Ludwig von Mises Can Get More Fans Than John Maynard Keynes, that page. Those two really have been a lot of support to the BadQuaker.com Facebook page and have helped us a ton. They've, recommended us a lot of times and stuff, and I really appreciate that from both those two groups. Now, another thing about Facebook that I found very helpful is that it allowed me to connect with people that I would normally, normally I would have to email and deal with that. And email is great. Email is a wonderful invention. But it's kind of slow, and it's kind of, you get a lot of spam and stuff in email that you end up just ignoring a lot of it. So by having Facebook, it's allowed me to have one-on-one conversations with people like Robert Higgs and his wife, Elizabeth Higgs, and some of the other people that are really influential in the liberty movement, and they're really good folks, and that I really wouldn't have had the opportunity to interface with them the way that I have without Facebook, and I really appreciate that. Now, that leads me into, should I jump right into that? Let me look at my notes here. No, before I get into that, speaking of Bob Higgs, I think it was Bob Higgs, it may not have been, but I think it was Bob Higgs that said something that inspired me to think, you know what, I need to do another one of those pictures for BadQuaker.com Facebook page. The statement was something about, maybe I saw that over at Lou Rockwell, I'm not sure. Anyway, the statement had something to do with how it used to be in the olden days. We're, talking like 1980s, 1990s. People would have an objection to the libertarian argument, and they would say, well, in your libertarian fantasy world, there'd be nobody to take care of old people, and handicapped children would never have wheelchairs, and there wouldn't be any wheelchair access in different places. And they always, this was something that they would always attack us, that libertarians are cold-blooded, and the libertarian a libertarian utopia, so to speak, would be a very cold-blooded place where it's dog-eat-dog and only the strong survive and all this kind of nonsense. And, of course, these are all straw-man arguments, and they're easily batted down one after the other. But it does get kind of tiresome when every single time people are bringing this up and throwing it in your face. But you don't see a lot of that with the same degree as you used to, specifically with elderly people and with the handicapped, because nowadays, it's not the state that's taking care of them, it's the state TSA agents that are molesting them. And so whoever it was that said that, and the more I think about it, the more I think I picked that up over at Lou Rockwell, one of the Lou Rockwell articles, somebody said that. But I thought immediately, I need to make a picture of that. I need to take a picture of one of the TSA agents and like an old man with a prosthetic leg, or an elderly lady in a wheelchair. There are a lot of those pictures floating around on the internet. You could easily pick one of them, a child, you know, a child in a wheelchair, or a child with crutches or something that really tugs at your heart. And then throw up the words up there that without the state, how would old ladies and children and the handicapped get molested? You know, or something like that. I haven't really worked out the wording yet, but I was thinking of doing some kind of a poster like that and throwing it up there at Bad Quaker and see if I couldn't, rattle the cage a little bit and knock loose some of the moths. Okay, the other thing about Facebook that I was going to lead into the discussion was that it's a wonderful thing. You know, I subscribe to a lot of different websites, including the Independent Institute, where Bob Higgs is one of the contributors for it. And, you know, I get email updates all the time from the Independent Institute, and I read their articles regularly. I go by over there and look around and stuff. But the nice thing about being connected to Bob Higgs on Facebook is when he writes something like that, he very often makes a note of it in Facebook. And so I can immediately go over there and see it. I don't have to wait around or whatever. And it doesn't have to be a big entry. It can just be some thoughts that he has. So I want to read, and that's exactly what he did. So I want to read something that he wrote on, let's see, Sunday. So yesterday he wrote this. It's titled, and I'm not a good reader of somebody else's stuff. I can read my own stuff fairly decent, but I'm not a good reader of other people's stuff. So forgive my clumsy reading of Bob Higgs's article here. But he titled it, "Want to Rip Off Your Neighbors? Form a Government." Facts of the case. My wife and I live in an area with one neighbor nearby. One day, I knocked on my neighbor's door and demanded that he give me $10,000. He wants to know what the devil I'm talking about. I explain that the people, most of them, in any event, in our area have seceded from St. Tammany Parish and the state of Louisiana and the United States of America and formed a new government, whose territory comprises his property and our property. We have also written and ratified our own... Oh, I'm sorry, I read that wrong. We have also written and ratified, with our own votes of approval, a constitution for the new country, which we have decided to call Southland. We have also conducted elections in which a two-thirds majority of the eligible voters elected Elizabeth and me to fill all of the new government offices, including tax collector. I won that one myself, he says. My neighbor protests that he has never heard of any of these developments and wants nothing to do with them, to which I reply that he has no choice in the matter because the Constitution of Southland gives its government the power to tax, and I am the duly elected tax collector, and he is at fault for not following the news more closely and not participating in the public affairs. Moreover, the Constitution provides for an army to enforce Southland's laws. I have been duly appointed chief of staff, and if he refuses to pay his tax, the authorities will have no choice but to use violence against him to compel that payment. He protests that this whole scheme is madness, that I have gone mad too, and that he will not give us one dime. Elizabeth and I then form up the ranks of Southland's army. I constitute the infantry, armed with my trusty shotgun, and she leads the army band, which consists of herself with her flute. We march to our neighbor's house and threaten to kill him if he does not pay us the $10,000 tax authorized in a statute enacted by Southland's new government. When he decides that a $10,000 loss is better than being killed by violent maniacs, we march home to the treasury, it's at our house, with our revenue, a sum whose use will be determined by the Southland legislature, in which Elizabeth and I are the duly elected lawmakers. Now, questions for the student. Except with regard to scale, and the voting by a woman, how does the preceding account differ in any essential way from the situation brought about by the formation of the United States of America? Then in parentheses he writes, hint, look up Whiskey Rebellion or read something that challenges the orthodox history of taxation. It's a wonderful little article by Bob Higgs. I really like reading that. Of course, it's a thought experiment. But it's a thought experiment that is really fun to deal with. If you think about of what he's really presenting to you, think about that for a second. I'm going to break. We're going to toss in our commercial break here. And I'll be right back with you in 2 minutes. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug-out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Thanks very much for sticking with me through the commercial. Before we get back to Bob Higgs' little story, I realized that I had missed talking about something when I was talking about Facebook. There's a wonderful new Facebook page that's called UNWE Libertarian Students Club. And it is actually Bulgarian students. It's set up by students in Bulgaria. They're Bulgarian students. And most of the content is in Bulgarian, but they also speak English, as many European people do. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up is because it just amazes me that there are so many libertarian or liberty-oriented organizations all around the world. This is really, really catching on. There are Ludwig von Mises institutes springing up all around the world on a regular basis. It's just amazing to spot that on Facebook. And I went over there right away and looked around at their site. And like I say, most of it's in Bulgarian, so it doesn't do me much good. But it's very heartwarming to me to realize this. I suppose this kind of applies to what Bob Higgs's article is talking about. I'll see if I can tie it together at a little bit here. So in Bob's article, we have, Bob and his wife have a vote, and they decide that they are separating themselves from the mother country, and they're forming their own new country, and they just arbitrarily include their neighbor's property in their country. And in doing so, then they go over and just march in there and just tell the neighbor, hey, by the way, guess what? You're part of our country, and we're taxing you now. And then Bob, at the end of the thing, very correctly says, if you want more to read on that, check out the Whiskey Rebellion. Well, this is a perfect example, actually, because, you know, I've touched on this on several different articles and different podcasts, but I want to bring it up again. What, you know, the story of what we're told, the story that's told in government schools, oddly enough, favors the government. Wow. But, you know, really, I mean, that's, sure, that's obvious, but really the story that, the typical storyline that's told with organizations like the History Channel and typical history books that are written specifically to be consumed by government schools and you know, all of that history and all of the Hollywood version of history, it's all just horribly, horribly twisted from the actual facts of what was going on around the time of the War of Independence. And, you know, I bring this up pretty regularly. I don't call it the Revolutionary War because there was no revolution. It was not a revolution. The United States, the colonies at that time, never attempted to, you know, to take over the government in London, to toss out Parliament and set up their own form of government. They didn't do that. That would be a revolution. They didn't. They simply demanded a separation from a government that was over them. So therefore, it was an act of independence. It was not an act of revolution. So there was no revolution in the United States at that time. It was a war of independence. It was not a revolution. And this is the same thing with the so-called Civil War. First off, it wasn't a civil war. Civil war is where one group of people tried to it's like a revolution. One people attempt to take over or destabilize and throw out the existing government, usually with the intent of setting up a new government or to establish a different government. Well, that's not what happened between 1861 and 1860, whatever it was, five or whatever. That's not this. The so-called Civil War was not a civil war. It was not a revolution. They weren't rebels. They were not rebels. Folks in the South, I know you like to call yourself rebels, but the Confederacy was not rebels. They were not revolting. It was an act of independence. They were attempting to separate themselves and make a new nation. They were not attempting to revolt or be rebels and conquer Washington. As a matter of fact, it probably would have been, from a technical standing, it probably would have been a smarter thing if Lee had actually done a direct assault on Washington. So this is not the Civil War podcast, so let's not get into that. Either way, so I'm a history geek, and I get particular about these kinds of words. There was no American Revolution. It was a war of independence. Now, what was I talking about? Oh, yeah. So during the actual War of Independence, it's been pointed out by quite a few people, and you know, the numbers have been crunched over and over, and the myth that the majority of the colonists were actually behind, that they wanted a separation from England, that's just a myth. It wasn't the case. Very, very conservative estimates indicate that perhaps as much as two-thirds or three-quarters of the colonists either didn't want to separate or didn't care one way or the other. There was only about a third or less of the colonists that actually had an interest to separate themselves from England. Now, of that group, many of them did militarize and you know, or took whatever actions that they could to support the War of Independence. But really, we're still talking a minority. We're talking about a minority of people who wanted to actually break away from England. An almost equal size minority of people in the colonies were fiercely opposed to breaking away. And then again, an almost equal size minority had no interest one way or the other. Now, this takes us to Bob Higgs's little story there. In his scenario, he and his wife make up a two-thirds majority, and they absorb the neighbor as the one-third minority. And then they dictate to that one-third how things are going to be and how taxes are going to be, and they inflict that upon him at the point of a gun. Well, that's exactly what happened in the revolution, in the War of Independence. Except the numbers didn't even have the legitimacy that Bob Higgs's numbers did. There was, as I said, only about a third of the public that was actually interested in breaking away from Great Britain. Now, when you get away from the big cities on the East Coast, well, big for their day, when you get away from the population centers, I should say it like that, when you get away from the population centers on the East Coast and you move more towards Appalachia, you didn't even have close to a third of the support. Most of the support for breaking away from England took place in, you know, places like Virginia and Massachusetts and New York and eastern Pennsylvania. But you get out into western Pennsylvania and you get out into what is modern-day West Virginia and the Appalachians of eastern Kentucky. You get down into Tennessee, and as the Appalachians continue further south like that, there was very little, if any, interest in breaking away from England because most of Appalachia was, in essence, already broken away from England. Some of them had already formed a constitution. Some of them had already formed a very libertarian, very anarcho-capitalist government, if you can call it that. Technically, it's not a government because, according to a lot of people's definition, a government has to be a monopoly of violence within a geographic area. Well, they didn't have that. It was an anarcho-capitalist society in Appalachia, and they did not tolerate a monopoly of violence. Your monopoly of violence ends at your property line, buddy. You come onto my property line with your monopoly of violence, and I'll show you what a monopoly of violence feels like. Well, that's the way the people of Appalachia felt. And then one day, along comes a guy, and he says, "I'm from the new government. And guess what? All the whiskey you people produce, you have to pay me a tax for it." "Oh, really? Is that so? Well, that's funny, because we didn't have anything to do with your forming of your little government. We didn't have a say-so in it. You did it pretty much without asking us, without even telling us you were doing it. And now you're going to come out here with force of arms?" I believe, if I recall, Washington marched something like 10,000 troops. I'm not sure. I could be wrong on that number. But if memory serves, I could, you know, like pop up Wikipedia and just look. But if memory serves, just off the top of my head, I believe it was 10,000 troops that Washington marched into western Pennsylvania as a show of force to try to inflict the whiskey tax upon the residents of Appalachia. And it didn't work, actually. Unlike what the history books lie and try to tell you, it didn't work. His show of force simply didn't work. First off, and I've said this before, Washington didn't have the authority to even muster a military. He needed an excuse to muster a military. So what he actually did was he ordered two generals that he knew very well. One was a drunkard and the other was an idiot. And he knew that. Washington knew that. And he ordered those two generals to march on one of the largest encampments of Indians of the day. And so we have one of the battles of Wabash because of this, and the military suffered the worst defeat in its history up until even now. Percentage wise, the army was devastated by this loss, and then Washington used. Now keep in mind, Washington sent them in. Washington, having an understanding of military, so we're told, sent in two inept commanders with their troops into almost definite suicide mission. He sent them in. the very strong group of Indians that was there, which was a large collection of a group of different tribes, and they were all coming together to for a very, very large meeting, very similar to what Custer rode into in his stupidity. But they did this in the Wabash Valley. And Washington knowingly sent his troops in there. Now, how do I say knowingly? Well, you know, Washington didn't exactly know how many Indians were in there. But Washington knew enough, I would make the argument, and I've read the letters and everything, and I would make the argument that Washington knew enough to know that it was not going to be a successful campaign. Let's put it that way. So Washington sends in these two commanders with their troops, and they just get literally wiped out. Just wiped out. Horrible, horrible defeat. And then Washington goes to Congress and he says, look, we have this Indian emergency. We're under a state of emergency. I need 10,000 troops right now. Because, you see, Washington didn't have the authority under the Constitution to even muster an army. Now think about that for a minute. Washington knew, all those guys around him, they'd read that thing, they knew about it. Many of them had just voted on it recently. Washington knew he didn't have the authority to muster troops. He had to ask Congress for it. So to handle this emergency, Congress authorizes these troops. And again, I believe it was 10,000, but you can check up on that pretty easily if you need to. So Washington then has congressional authorization to muster the troops because of this emergency. We have this emergency in what was called the Old Northwest, which was actually like Western Ohio and Indiana and in that area, Illinois. So Congress was under the impression that Washington, the hero Washington was going to lead the troops and go out there and solve the Indian problem. Well, what did he do instead? He went after tax protesters in western Pennsylvania. And he didn't have the guts to march straight from Washington, from Virginia. He didn't have the guts to march straight from Virginia or from Maryland and cut straight across into western Pennsylvania. He didn't have the guts to do that. If you pull up a map and look at it, take a look at the general area of Maryland and Washington, D.C. and Virginia, and look at, and just kind of draw a line in your mind to get to western Pennsylvania, you'd have to cut through what we now call West Virginia. That's the heart of Appalachian country. Washington had enough experience with the Appalachian people that he knew that if he marched a troop of 10,000 people through Appalachia without their permission, he'd be lucky to get back out with his own hair. Now that's the truth. They would have cut him apart. So he didn't try going through Appalachia. He went around. He went through the low country and snuck in. And he made sure that he never really went into the heart of Appalachia. And then he stomped around and he marched his men up and down. And they made a couple of arrests. And nothing ever stuck and no one was ever convicted. And then they left and they went back home. And the whiskey tax did not get paid. Because the tax collectors were still getting tarred and feathered, and Washington knew it was not something that he could win. Since I'm on this topic, and I didn't really even mean to talk about the Whiskey Rebellion, but since I'm on the topic and I'm talking about this much about it already anyway, let's keep in mind, the whiskey tax was pushed through by Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton had first... when he was aide-de-camp to Washington, or maybe he was just secretary, I can't remember for certain. Anyway, he was a flunky. He was a flunky that walked around behind Washington and went, "Yes, Mr. Washington, that's brilliant, Mr. Washington. My, Mr. Washington, you certainly are handsome today, Mr. Washington." That's Alexander Hamilton for you. Okay, now so Hamilton had done this same procedure with very influential bankers in New York. And he had gained friendship with these very influential bankers in New York, and then, using his position with Washington, convinced Washington to take out loans to finance arms deals Now check this out. This is hilarious if you really follow it through. Alexander Hamilton, in his position as an aide to Washington, convinced Washington that he needed to take out loans to buy arms with. Okay? So then Alexander Hamilton writes letters to these bankers that he had already written them letters complimenting them on other things. Like one of these bankers had written a book about economics. Well, Hamilton probably never even read the book. The legends of Hamilton being a great economist are entirely made up lies of the state. As far as we know, he only possessed this one book, and we don't have any evidence he actually read it. But he did write a letter to the author of that book, which was one of the high power bankers in New York. Here comes Baggy the cat. She's coming to beg for food. Hang on, Baggy. So Alexander writes this letter and kisses up to this banker. And the banker thought, wow, this guy really likes my book. And so then Alexander Hamilton goes to Washington and says, you know, what you really need is you need to buy a bunch of arms. Who are you going to buy the arms from? I happen to know an arms dealer. The arms dealer was in cahoots with the bankers. As a matter of fact, the arms dealer was one of the bankers. And then in addition to that, where did they get the arms from? Oddly enough, the bankers bribed the British generals and bought British arms. They bribed British generals, bought British armory, and sold it to Washington on loans guaranteed by Washington, because his promise was that Congress would make good on all the money. Then Hamilton, when it became obvious that the bankers were going to be stuck for this bill because Washington didn't have the authorization, Congress had authorized some funding, but not the kind of funding that they had run up this kind of bill. So Congress had no way of getting this money to pay these bankers with. They started printing money, but the more they printed, the less it was worth. So that the script became pretty much useless. So the bankers didn't want the script. They wanted real money. So Hamilton then pulls off this brilliant maneuver. You know what? Let's throw away the Articles of Confederation, bring in a federal government, and give it the right to tax. Give it the ability, not the right. Let's make a federal government and give it the ability to tax. Then we can pay off our war debt. Isn't that amazing? Oh, Hamilton, you're a genius. That's what you are. So there's a coup. There was literally a coup. People had gone for the Continental Congress to discuss adjusting a couple minor flaws in the Articles of Confederation. Hamilton handpicked people who were of that delegation to arrive early and have a meeting before the other guys showed up. In that meeting, he was able to have a majority, and they were able to get through the Constitution to form a federal government. By the time the other delegates had arrived, the convention had already taken place, and they'd already voted on a new federal government and a new Constitution. Now, a lot of people were upset about this. Immediately, some people like Jefferson and like Madison and like some of the others realized that they had lost the little chess game. It was over. It's time to compromise. So the Bill of Rights was a compromise on that. But it was ineffective, obviously. We look around, we see the government we have today. But not my point. I'll do a rant on that some other time. So Hamilton's plan worked perfectly. Hamilton got his federal government that he wanted. He got the ability to tax like he wanted. He got his man, Washington, in as the president. And he had all these bankers frothing at the mouth wanting their money because they weren't going to take the cheap counterfeit scripts that the government was putting out. So then Hamilton pushes through. Hamilton has this great idea. Washington, check out this idea. Let's have a whiskey tax. Now, why would Washington want to agree to a whiskey tax? Washington was the largest single producer of whiskey in the colonies, or in the newly formed government, in the newly formed country, rather. Washington was the largest whiskey producer. Hamilton's like, dude, you're president. You can figure out how to do this. So Washington got behind the whiskey tax. the whiskey tax gets passed, it's up to Washington to figure out how to enforce it. So lo and behold, Washington enforces it by Washington, George Washington, having the ability to assign what districts got taxed in what ways and who had to pay the tax in what manner. So that means that Washington, being the largest whiskey producer, only paid about half as much per gallon in tax as the producers in Pennsylvania and all through Appalachia. Washington literally used his position as president to drive out his competitors in the whiskey business. And it just so happened that right before all this took place, Hamilton went to his banker friends and said, look, you know, you don't have to worry. The government's good for all this money. And they're like, dude, we don't want any more of your paper. We want real money. And Hamilton then, being what Hamilton was, bought all of those, not all, but he and his friends together, he and his insider friends, they bought the loans, they bought the loans that the government had for financing the War of Independence. And then when Washington starts collecting the tax, who does that tax go to? It goes to the holder of the loans. The bankers? No. Hamilton and his buddies bought the loans. So Hamilton and his buddies got the money from the taxes. So Washington put up a false flag operation. We have Indian problems out in the Northwest. We had two whole troops were wiped out in the Northwest. I need Congress to give me a military. Congress, we need a tax to pay for our war debts from the War of Independence. Congress, we need a tax. Okay, here's your tax, Washington. Okay, here's your 10,000 troops, Washington. Go fight the Indians. I think I'll go and arrest some tax protesters instead. And where does the money go, Hamilton? Who gets the money, Hamilton? Yeah. Fun times. I was asked this question earlier in the week. How will you ever get 100% of the people to embrace liberty? What brought that question up was my statement that voting is immoral. When a group of people inflict their will upon a smaller group of people, that's immoral. If 51% of the public decides they want liberty, they want no oppressive government, they want only a voluntary society, and they have a vote, and they inflict their will to have a voluntary society upon 49% that prefer to have a state that drags them out of their car and tases them twice a week and does all these horrible things that the state does. Well, when the 51% vote and say, nope, we're going to have an all-volunteer society, a voluntarist society, and there's not going to be any coercive government, and aggression is not going to take place, and they inflict that upon the 49%, wouldn't that be tyranny? It would be. It absolutely would be. You can't vote in a free society. And so how will we have 100% of the people embracing liberty? Well, we first have to let 100% of the people see how evil the state really is. You have to watch the state, you have to let the state grow, and you have to point it out. And what I was talking about with Washington and what I was talking about with Hamilton, my purpose in that is to show that this is not new. This has been the way the state has been since day one. The nature of the state has never changed since all the way back there on the fertile plains of Jericho that I've written about before when the state was born. Since then, it has always been, and until its death, it will always be a hideous, nasty, evil creature that must die. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.